I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. One book deals with living on the Texas border in the 1980s and a family just wanting to be real Americans to the point of discarding a rich family tradition. Another deals with a cop reeling from PTSD. He finds a path to rehabilitation with a combat-worn dog. A third book answers this question: did Ernest Hemingway's wife murder him in a mercy killing? This hour, the book doctors return to share the best books stacked on their nightstands this month and help you find some reads to match the springtime weather. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. It's been a while since the book doctors paid a visit, and the beginning of spring is a good time to open up to some new ideas for good reads. We're going to talk poetry today, as April is National Poetry Month, and we're going to talk about Boy Kings of Texas, the dark horse nominee that surprised everyone at the National Book Awards. We're also going to go multi-platform. We'll talk about books and apps and audiobooks, too. Our book doctors today are Jeffrey Ann Gowdy. She's a freelance writer, editor, and reviewer. Jeff, always good to have you. Good
morning.
Nice
to be here, Steve.
Mark Luce is with the Barstow School. Mark, good morning.
Good morning.
Grace is a writer and editor. Grace, how are you?
I'm very well.
Katie Stover is director of reader services at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library. How are you, Katie?
Very well. Thanks, Steve.
So what's new in the book world, Mark? What's happening?
Well, I thought if we could take just one very quick minute. In the last month or so, we lost two people associated with the book doctors. First,
absolutely.
In 1997, I think, I got a call from the station to join John Mark Eberhardt and Steve Paul and Angela Elam to come and talk once a month about books. And that was with Walt, and it was quite a bit of fun. And
what year was that?
I think it was 1997.
No kidding.
Yeah, so it was a while ago.
Yeah, no kidding. It goes back farther than I thought.
I'm getting older.
We all are. Yeah.
But I just wanted to take a minute to thank, both of those guys had a huge impact on me, and I'm sure everybody else here at the table, and their loss will be felt.
Also, speaking of poetry, John Mark, his second collection, I believe, was Broken Time. It was out in 2008, and I loved that book, and I did talk about it on Book Doctors, and John Mark was kind of red-faced, but really appreciative. He's a very talented poet, as well as a book doc and other things.
We miss our buddy, that's for sure. What a great loss for the book world and the poetry world and everything else from around here. Katie, what else is going on in books and all good things like that?
Oh, well, I didn't get a chance to read the story this morning, but Publishers Weekly published a little snippet that said tablets are now the preferred device for e-reading over e-readers. And I was talking with Jeff about that in the green room, and she said, I haven't touched an electronic device for reading. So I know that Jeff is one of our print readers. I know that Mark is finally a convert to electronic things, even though we've been duking it out over audiobooks for years and years. But that doesn't really surprise me that people are reading more on their tablets than their e-readers, because they're doing other things on the tablets. And so what they're doing is they're reading when they're filling in time, when they're not checking their Facebook or reading the news.
So tablets like the iPad.
Like the iPad.
Yeah, and, right. And e-readers are just too small, right?
Yeah, some of them are just too small. some of them, they're just in black and white. And people want a tablet looks like an open book. So they like the format. It's also a little bit lighter. Battery life lasts a little bit more. Backlighting.
I think there are two things at play here. One, I think, is people like to read in bed, and so right, you have the backlit sort of issue. And honestly, I think while all those are very good reasons, the fact of the matter is that most people want to play, you know, mini golf matchup or Angry Birds or surf the web. Right, while they're reading, or at least have the option to do so.
So just to make sure I heard Katie correctly here, so she's saying that even Mark Luce is using tablets now to read.
Well, let's not get carried away.
Are the planets realigning here, or what's happening?
Let us not get carried away. I will read occasionally a book on the iPad only if I can't find my copy, which often happens, and I'm reading it for school. Occasionally, I'll read things that are basically hard to get in print, but you can get an electronic version. So lots of like very pulpy 40s and 50s novels you can find electronic copies of. And then actually all my long form journalism, I read online. All of it I read through InstaReader on the iPad at night because I can see it. So I still get to read magazines, but without turning on the light and waking up my wife.
It's just more convenient.
Oh, it's much more convenient, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm reading all my magazines online now, too.
Are you?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll offer a contrary opinion here. Our colleague Steve Paul, who is not with us today, recently had an article in the Kansas City Star about the slow books movement, a return to the physical object of the book away from the e-reader.
Oh, I expected that.
Music to my ears.
The slow book.
Since I have virgin fingers that have never touched an e-reader.
Is that spearheaded by Melville? Is he the leader of the slow books movement?
Did you read on an iPad, Jeff, yourself?
No.
No.
Oh,
that's an emphatic no, just for the record. Yeah.
She'll take offense at that.
Yeah. Just not there.
No, I'm so attached to the physical object. And also, you know, in our cave, we don't even have a microwave, so, you know.
No kidding. Why no microwave?
Oh, just
because they have a fireplace. That's why.
There you go.
Who needs a microwave when you got a fireplace?
Right.
Okay, I get
but
it.
But you love the internets.
This is true. And I love Facebook, which is a huge time suck that I get sucked into. But yeah.
Well, at this point, we could continue our conversation about books, or we could talk about allergies, which your host is suffering from dearly here this morning. I hope I don't sound too croaky out there.
There is one thing that I read about I think 4 or 5 days ago. Amazon, the behemoth that it is, bought Goodreads.
That's right.
Yes, they did.
And so Goodreads is basically I don't want to say it's not a fan site, but it's like people who like books go there and they give each other recommendations.
A community.
Yeah, it's a community. And the initial scuttlebutt on it is not very positive from the Goodreads community, because basically what Amazon is buying is a bunch of names, email addresses, and
reviews.
Reviews and book choices and, you know, stars and that kind of thing. And Ron Charles, who edits the Washington Post, he does a little video thing every once in a while called the Hip Book Reviewer, and the irony is it's not hip at all. And
he's
very funny, and he did one on the purchase of Goodreads by Amazon, where his Hip Book Reviewer gets bought by Amazon, and it is wildly funny.
This is goodreads.com.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. One word.
Yes.
Yeah.
Soon to be Amazon.
Well, you know, I'll be a devil's advocate here, because Amazon is the devil. We all know that. But I will say that the devil is my friend. And even though I know it's bad, and even though I know that I'm helping the bad guys, I'm an Amazon fan, and I have been for a long time. And I buy a lot of my books on Amazon purely because it's a Faustian. It's not even a bargain. It's because it's so convenient. And I have to admit that everybody was complaining about Goodreads being bought by Amazon, in a really bad part of me just thought, well, that'll be really convenient because then I can keep it all integrated, because I have a problem keeping all of my book sites integrated. Mm. And I often think to myself, I'm so sorry about this.
You know, I'm still confused, Mark, when we talk about Goodreads being bought by Amazon, the threat, the danger here is what exactly?
Well,
that they're going to continue it.
The threat is that it's Amazon. I mean, that's
and
the
they'll
threat.
Know what books, they'll Amazon know what books
will,
we like.
Amazon is going to come into Steve Kraske's brain and take all of his preferences for everything from toothpaste to, you know, what particular kind of historical fiction you like, and then zap advertisements to your brain constantly that will make you purchase things from them. I mean, that's. In all honesty, the hyperbole is kind of that much. A giant bookseller bought a book site. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the – I think people just don't
people
like –
People are hysterical about
yeah,
it.
People are hysterical about it.
Goodreads is useful. Readers like Goodreads because the reviews are written by readers. And recently, Amazon's been taking a couple of dings for – for reviews on their website written by somebody's mom or the author themselves or paying someone.
Well, you never know
who's
writing those reviews on Amazon. That's always the issue, right?
Or the other thing, there was that person, I forget who it was, who had written hundreds, maybe thousands of reviews for pay.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. Right.
Posing as an objective reader.
That's right. And you can't trust those. Whereas on Goodreads, you're connected to your friends. And so you're reading reviews by people you know or friends of friends, and it's a more trustworthy base.
Yeah, it's a little more honest. You're going to write, I really like this, I really didn't. The Goodreads folks don't have control over what you're writing over the reviews. And I'm going to join Grace here and be devil's advocate for a second. If I were Amazon, I'd be interested in that review content because it's reader-generated. And people trust their friends, and it's probably going to be a little more accurate. Some authors might not like that, but when I go looking for reviews from readers, I'm more prone to check Goodreads than I am Amazon.
What other book websites do you recommend? When we're on the topic here, what else sort of stands out to you?
Library Thing, Shelfari. I think Goodreads is used far more than Library Thing or Shelfari.
Is Goodreads sort of the number one alternative?
I think so.
It's the YouTube of book sites.
And Amazon owns either Library Thing or Shelfari as well. I can't remember which one, but now they own Goodreads.
I really like the Powell's website. I think the Powell's website is...
And tell us about that.
It's
Powell's.com?
Yeah. I mean, it's...
P-A-L-S?
No, Powell's, like the bookstore in...
Powell's. Yeah, sure. Yeah.
The thing is, like all those... anywhere you go to buy books, it's basically going to be pretty much the same experience. Their layout, I think, is a little more friendly. And I like that bookstore in general. So I'll buy stuff from them every once in a while.
Because you're a better person than
No.
I buy stuff from
Amazon all the time. Right? I buy stuff from Amazon all the time, and I'm not going to...
Do you buy used?
Actually, quite a bit.
I do, too. Those prices are so crazy.
Yeah. Well, and then in a weird way, you are kind of supporting an independent bookseller with a middleman.
Yeah.
You know, and you'll find a lot of bookstores increasingly have moved some of their used content onto various web platforms, then they're not just selling at Amazon. They're probably also selling at Powell's or eBooks. You know, any place like that.
Yeah. But back to the content of Goodreads. My brother-in-law, who teaches at a private school in Massachusetts, writes reviews for Goodreads that are just really high quality. Mm-hmm. And it's not something I want to do. It'd be like a journeyman's holiday for me, but I really appreciate the reviews I read by my friends.
Again, that's goodreads.com. Okay. Let's go to some new books here. Katie Stover, you have one, Print the Legend by Craig McDonald.
Oh, I'm a recent convert to Craig McDonald's crime novels. And this one is the third entry in his Hector Lassiter series. And Hector Lassiter is a fictional character who is one of the last great crime writers of the Pulp magazine era. And he's also one of Ernest Hemingway's good buddies. And in previous Hector Lassiter novels, Hemingway and Hector team up to solve a murder in Key West. And this book opens in 1965, 4 years after Hemingway's death, in Ketchum, Idaho, at a Hemingway literary conference. And Lassiter is the keynote speaker, but he's also in town to work with Hemingway's widow, Mary, who is presented in this book as just a shrill, shrewd woman who just wants to gold mine Hemingway's left behind papers and snippets for whatever she can, and also write her own autobiography, because doesn't everyone want to read about Mary Hemingway? Well, no, they don't. But but Hector's also there because he's hoping to find one of his own missing short stories that disappeared in a valise lost by Hadley Hemingway some time ago in Paris in the 20s. So as Hector's digging around in Hemingway's papers, he begins to suspect that the widow Hemingway may have hastened her husband's death a little bit.
Whoa.
Now, that is a bare bones outline of this book. It's complex. It's surprising. It's very deftly written. It's wholly original. And it might be the third in the series. And don't bother trying to read them in order. Just read them in the order in which the author wrote them. They are not in chronological order whatsoever. Because there's just no order to this. But I just get sucked into this story and I have no idea where the author is going next. And he does a great deal of research. So all of his fiction is based on a lot of research and nonfiction. J. Edgar Hoover shows up in this book. Lots of other writers from the time.
Is he, you know, saying if all these historical people come up and there's some literary people, in a way, is there any resemblance to old Kansas City writer James Elroy?
Yes, except it's probably not as dark in tone. It really is.
It would be hard to be that.
It's almost pulpy. It's almost as if Craig McDonald is trying to ape that pulp magazine writing style from the 40s and 50s. And he is, to an extent. But he's also trying to write a very smart crime thriller that keeps the reader guessing. And he does. I read an awful lot of this sort of thing. And when I can kind of guess what's going on halfway through, then I'm a little bit bored. But I'll keep on going if the writing's really snappy. And it is. Fans of crime fiction with a literary bent will not be disappointed. But you'll probably have a lost weekend when you try to read all of McDonald's Lassiter Hemingway novels.
That's Print the Legend.
Print the Legend.
Craig McDonald.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Mark Luce, Building Stories by Chris Ware.
Okay. This is a – I got this as a gift at Xmas time. And all my – besides not only my family, but my kids and my wife, but also my relatives wondered why I was carrying around – so Building Stories is by Chris Ware. Chris Ware is a novelist, a graphic novelist who wrote Billy Corgan, The Smartest Boy on Earth, which is one of the best graphic novels really around and that I've ever read. It's also one of the most depressing stories that's ever been printed. Building Stories comes in a box that is about the size of a board game.
You have it right in front of you.
Yeah,
yes,
and
that's
inside
quite a product.
The box are 14 different print items. So there are little tiny kind of pamphlets. There's a small hardback book. There's a newspaper. There are a variety of different comics. There's a board from a board game that kind of slides out, and you can read the narrative on that. And here's the thing. So you've got these 14 different ways of telling this story. There are no directions. So you don't... there's no order to read them in.
Wow.
So you actually build the story. One of the great – so what Ware does is he basically – you're in a Chicago neighborhood and you're basically sort of looking at one building. And in the building we follow – and they're really not named. So there's an aging landlady who lives on the bottom floor. There's a couple who just bickers and fights. And then there's an art student who is – doesn't have much luck, who has a prosthetic leg. And so their stories sort of interrelate over time. In this particular building, Ware says that it's had 301 tenants, 178 trysts, 469 feelings of being watched, 29 broken hearts, 104 writers, and 4 criminals. It's the thing that I like about this is from a narrative point of view, right, it's so disjointed, and yet depending on how you approach it each time, if you approach it differently each time, you would get a little bit different feeling about each of the characters, depending on what order you found out certain things about their lives. I mean, like Ware's other stuff, it's about memory, it's about loss, it's about trauma, that's kind of his calling card. It reminds me quite a bit of Will Eisner's City of God trilogy. Mm-hmm. In that, he traces basically a one tenement building over a span of 60 or 70 years. And so there's a part of me that thinks that this is sort of Ware's nod to Eisner by doing it this way. But it's if you're not willing to play this game, it's not worth your time.
I've never seen anything like that before.
I have never seen anything like it. So I mean, there hasn't really been anything like
it.
It's
like a choose-your-own-adventure,
yeah, exactly.
But a build-your-own-story.
Yeah.
So these are disparate. These are discrete stories, but that are connected?
Sort of. I mean, you can pick one up, and you might not know what's going on. I mean, there's one that's just basically a little strip that's about 8 panels. The board game is – it looks like you fold it out, and it's a board game, but it's got the comic – it's got the illustrations right on it. And so you might know, and you don't know which way do you open them, which way do you go, how do you read on the page. I mean, it shifts perspective. It's like, I won't go so far as to say it's a fun house of a story, but you're getting pretty darn close. But
what's this box cost? Can I ask?
Oh yeah, it was I think it was like $60.
No kidding.
Maybe it was 50. I don't know. I got it on Amazon for cheap.
Yeah.
And they're currently out of stock. But when I tell people about it and how excited I was, they're just like, dude, you need serious help.
Well, except that this book was extremely critically acclaimed. It was one of the New York Times Book Review's 10 best.
Mm-hmm. No kidding.
Yeah.
Of last year. 2012.
It's $50. Mm-hmm. $50 retail. So, yeah. And it's, again, you have to be willing to play, and I would wildly urge you to read some of Ware's stuff before you dive in, so that you at least, I mean, he can be a cold bath. You're like, what just happened? And so, starting with something like Jimmy Corrigan or the Acme novelty series would be a good place. But this is as fun of an experience as I've probably ever had reading.
Wow. Wow, that's amazing. That's Building Stories by Chris Ware. Great recommendation from Mark Luce. Let's go to Becky from Parkville. Becky, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Good morning. I just called to share one of my new guilty pleasures.
Yeah.
Is I love to watch the television show Castle, whose leading character is Richard Castle, an author, who is using his experiences in the show to write his book. You can get those books written by Richard Castle. There's a fake website, richardcastle.net, and you can find the books they talk about in the TV show and actually read them. Such as
wow.
Naked Heat, Gathering Storm, based on his character Derek Storm that made him a best-selling author. It kind of crosses the line, obviously, of all entertainment. It's TV, it's internet, it's books, and it's just really entertaining to see how they've taken this fictional character and created a real author. I have no idea who the people really are who are writing these books, but they have a great sense of humor, and it's really fun.
I'll have to check that out.
Yeah.
The only episode of Castle I've ever seen featured three of my favorite authors around a poker table, Michael Connelly, George Pelicanos, and Dennis Lehane. And John Mark Eberhart was with me when I saw that episode.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And they have the authors on the TV show once in a while playing the poker games. It's kind of a standing thing that they do once in a while and joke about how his experiences fit into his books. And it's just really funny how you'll watch the TV show and the first season he writes Naked Heat, and there's all of this discussion about the lead character and how, you know, he's used her to make his book, and then you read the book and see how the episodes you've watched fit into how he wrote the book.
Oh, that's interesting.
All right.
Yeah, it's really interesting. They're not, I told the screener, they're not going to win any literary awards. They're not, you know, fantastic reads, except for they're really entertaining.
All right. Becky, thanks for the call. I appreciate
it. Thank
you. All right.
You're welcome.
Jeff, let's move to a book here, Mary Coyne by Marissa Silver. It's a novel.
Yeah, Mary Coyne by Marissa Silver. And the listener can't see this either, just like the listener could not see the Chris Ware Building Stories. But this book jacket has a photo that is arguably the most famous photo from the Great Depression, the migrant mother photo.
Oh, yeah, right. However,
on the dust jacket, it's cropped and colorized, and so it is sort of a more it's a gimmick. But the story itself is not colorized at all. This is very much a Dirty 30 novel. The historical figure who took the pictures, the photographer Dorothea Lange, and the subject of the photograph, the migrant mother, is Florence Owens Thompson, which was not known at the time but was later discovered. And the stand-ins for these characters are Vera Dare is Dorothea Lange, and Mary Coyne, the eponymous a name here, is the subject of the photograph, who is Florence Owens Thompson. There is a contemporary character as well, a social historian who decodes photographs for clues to the larger historical past, and who also teaches a class on decoding photographs. But in any case, this book alternates the three stories. We start with Mary Coyne. She really has the most compelling story. This is very much Depression era. She has a hardscrabble existence in the 20s in Oklahoma. She marries very young. She has a brood of children. Her husband contracts tuberculosis and dies, and then she breaks off with her kids and tries to make a living with some dignity in migrant worker camps. She really doesn't have much dignity at all. It's a really terrible existence. And the photographer Vera Dare has had a hard life as well. She had a pretty carefree childhood in New Jersey, but then she contracted polio, got a limp. The father left the family. So they moved to New York. The mother goes to work in the library, and Vera Dare takes to studying passersby on the sidewalk, which then leads to her becoming a photographer of wealthy subjects, and she marries a philanderer, and finally ends up finding her own artistic vision, taking pictures from the Great Depression. At the end of this book, Walker Dodge, who's been called home to go through his father's belongings, goes into his grandfather's library, opens up a book of poetry, and out shakes a yellowed photograph from a newspaper of the migrant mother. And he goes downstairs and finds the name Mary Coyne on the payroll ledgers, only she's paid a lot more. So then the three stories come together. Marissa Silver is a very well-respected novelist. I'd never read anything she'd written before, but I would very much recommend this book. It's very textured, very resonant. I've actually seen comments from the family of Florence Owens Thompson, who said, you know, this is a novel. This is not history. And apparently the family is a little bit incensed, and they're putting out their own story this summer. Because in this book, the subject of the photograph actually sues the photographer, and she said that never happened in real life. I mean, this person who was commenting on a website. But very much an excellent book.
Mary Coyne by Marissa Silver, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our good conversation here with the book doctors. We'll turn to a bunch of other books. Let's see. Boy Kings of Texas. We'll get to Tiny Beautiful Things by Cheryl Strayed. We'll talk about an audiobook titled Quiet by Susan Cain. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed yesterday's opening day broadcast from the K, you can find it and all of our previous broadcasts at kcur.org. On tomorrow's program, we'll sit down with former newspaper columnist Ellen Goodman for a discussion on ways to approach death as a natural part of life. This hour, we're visiting with our book doctors today, Jeffrey Ann Gowdy, Mark Luce, Grace Suh, and Katie Stover, running through all kinds of interesting books. Grace Suh, you're up next year. You want to go multi-platform, and you want to speak about an audiobook, Quiet by Susan Cain.
Well, it is available in every format, but I listen to it on audiobook on audible.com. Sorry, Jeffrey. You know, when the hands are free, then I can do other things while I listen. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to ask you a personal question.
Mm-hmm.
Do you consider yourself an extrovert or introvert?
Extrovert.
Yeah, I would agree.
So. We're all in agreement on that point.
You're surrounded
here, right?
By introverts.
You're book people. I like book people, though.
So years ago, The Atlantic Monthly published a little article called The Care and Feeding of Your Introvert. And it got a huge, huge response. And it basically, it said, if you are not an introvert, then you do have an introvert in your life, and you are probably driving that person crazy. Because you're demanding that person smile and talk and chit-chat, and they don't want to do any of those things. And I live in a divided household, and it was suggested to me that I read this book so that I could understand how other people feel. So I did.
Other people, yeah.
That's right. And I also have two children, and I would say that probably one is one and one is the other. And I have to say I approached this book reluctantly, and I learned so much.
Mm. It's gotten great buzz around it.
Absolutely. Yeah. It has. In my library, there are hundreds of people in line ahead of me, so I had to shell out bucks to get it. And so I hope that's appreciated by the person who recommended it.
Yeah.
And it has thousands of reviews on Amazon.com. And basically, Kane's thesis is this, that America is an extroverted country. In fact, it is such an extroverted country, we don't even think about it because it's so obvious the fact that you take it for granted. And being American means being cheerful, being energetic, being peppy, and being talkative. And if you're none of those things, then what in the world is wrong with you?
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And, we revere cheerleaders and jocks and student body presidents,
yeah.
Businessmen, salesmen. Even in the field of religion, the people who are looked up to are people. You know, it's being a people person is considered a compliment,
mm-hmm.
and not being a people person is considered a problem.
Yeah, I buy that. I buy that.
Yeah, and so that
people
even
think
in,
that.
Yeah, and
I don't
even
agree
in,
with that, but people do tend
and
to believe that.
And even in job descriptions, they ask for people. You know, you must be a people person, and if you're not a people person, well, don't even bother applying. And yes, if you are a minister. You know, you need to be a peppy minister. You need to be a person who hail fellow well met, patting people on the back all the time kind of person. And in that, a lot of people who think they have social anxiety disorder are just not extroverts, and it's killing them to try to be extrovert.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really interesting. And then she talks about the fact that being an introvert is not a problem. It is not the absence of extroversion. It is the presence of a lot of other factors, such as increased sensitivity. And these are actually physiological things that they can test and prove. People who are introverted actually take in more physical stimuli. And so they are actually perceiving more. They're observing more.
They're just doing it quietly.
That's right. Yeah. Exactly. They're just as intelligent as other people. But for instance, in meetings, it's the people who speak up who are considered the leaders,
mm-hmm.
whereas the people who don't speak up might have ideas that are just as valuable. And it's really, really interesting. And her contention is that we're losing out on a lot of talent and brain power because we discount people who don't assert themselves, that assertiveness is considered such a value in our society.
And how is the audio book? Does she read it?
You know, that's a good question. Whoever read it very quietly.
Oh, really? Is she an introvert? Is Susan Cain, the author, is she an introvert or an extrovert?
She's an introvert who was in the business world and did very well in the business world, but had to find a way to because the business world rewards assertiveness, she had to find a way to contend in the business world on her own terms. And she says something very interesting about the business world, which is that this open model floor plan that all these companies adopt where nobody has any privacy and everybody's out in the open, that it's really damaging to introverts. And not only that, but when they do studies, they find that offices in which people have private spaces – people are actually more productive and do better work.
Oh, that's interesting.
So the science goes against this popular belief that the more extroverted an environment.
You know, it's interesting in the newsroom at the Star, there are those who are introverts who, you know, over time build these fortresses stacks of paper and books sort of all around them so they can have some privacy. And I sort of get that. It's amazing to behold because there are documents from 1934, you know, in those stacks all around them.
They're trying to protect themselves.
And they're very, very meticulously constructed sort of walls. And again, I can appreciate that. That's all fine, but it's interesting.
Does Kane address that in terms of education?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. She talks about the fact that the goal of education is to have children speak up, A, And, you know, class mm-hmm. discussion is a big thing. Mm-hmm. Why don't you discuss in class? Oh, you did very well in class discussion. That's a grade. You get graded on class mm-hmm. discussion. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and not only that, that kids have to sit in these communal tables. And this is the thing she hates most of all, that kids have to do group projects.
Mm.
And she has a lot to say about group projects, not only in the education level, but in the workplace, which is that group projects tend to lower the overall quality of the work. And that it's not only torture for the introverted people, but that it's so much less productive.
But isn't there an argument that if while I certainly can understand like wanting to accommodate the introvert, I mean, at the same time, right, the fact of the matter is, right, we do live in an extroverted society, and in order to do some things, I mean, being able to communicate effectively, like I don't make kids do class discussion because mm-hmm. I'm trying to like, ha, 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 check it out. Hey, introvert, you got to speak up. Yeah. It's a matter of learning how to speak for yourself and, frankly, in an environment that is beyond safe,
mm-hmm.
right? Not in an environment, you know, they don't have to go give a speech at City Hall, right? They're in sort of an organized classroom. So, like, I can see – I mean, I'm sort of intrigued by this book, but I'm also – I mean, as a teacher both in high school and at college, right, and as a parent, I want people to be able to communicate effectively. And if you allow people just to hide and never take them out of that introversion comfort zone, mm-hmm. then they're never going to be able to do that. I mean, I'd like to think there's some kind of balance that could be.
Well, I understand what you're saying, and I think that's very good point. But
yeah.
But what she is saying is that in past times and in other cultures, people who would never have been able to really contribute to a class discussion in your class,
sure.
You know, Sir Isaac Newton, Proust, were able to do great things in their lives because they weren't pushed to do things that are just so far beyond their comfort level. That's
despite your good intentions, Barbara.
Yeah. Clearly,
that these days, what we're doing is we're making it impossible for, you know, for the Steve Wozniaks of the world, who were only able to produce what they did in complete solitude. That we're never giving them that environment.
Yeah, I struggle with that.
I mean, as a teacher, I find that that seems. I just don't believe that. I mean, kids have all kinds of kids are encouraged in all kinds of different ways to pursue their own projects and to do their own thing. And I mean, it's probably a function. I mean, I'm lucky to teach where I teach, and we encourage creativity, and we have, you know, we have kids that are certainly introverts that you know, they can't say they don't want to talk at all.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems to me that sort of lumping. You know, it's easy to pick out like a Newton or an Einstein or something and say, like, all I'm talking about is being able to communicate effectively in a daily operation.
Right.
And being, again, like, I can't get past the you're in a safe spot. Like, that's the thing I always tell the kids. Oh, I don't like to read out loud. Well, you know, I'm sorry, but you're going to read out loud.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And you will never be in a safer environment than this.
Well,
no one's
going
to make fun of you. No one's going to.
Right.
You know what I mean? So, I mean, I get it. I'm really curious about – I have a feeling this book would make me really mad.
Well, it sounds like everyone is having a turn reading out loud in your class, and it's not something where you have to fight for your chance to speak up, because she's talking a lot about university classes where people don't volunteer because it's hard for them to fight over the melee of all those people who do assert themselves.
Sure.
And I'm speaking as someone who, you
or
know,
they
every
don't
report.
Do the reading.
Well, yeah, exactly. Every report card that I ever brought home said Grace needs to stop talking in class.
True confessions from Grace here. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Book Doctors here on KCUR. We're visiting with Jeffrey Ann Gowdy, Mark Luce, Grace Saw, and Katie Stover. We have an email here from Jennifer Mark Luce. She wants to know about your recommendation in our first half today about the book Building Stories. How old should a reader be before trying building stories?
Well, I mean, it has
35
adult material. Yeah. You know, a sophisticated high schooler could probably be okay. I mean, there's nothing mm-hmm. they're not going to see on South Park or something like that. But I would say the problem with this book is, honestly, it's not so much of an age or the subject. It's a matter of, like, your kind of narrative sophistication. So a more sophisticated reader who is younger could probably really have a good time with it. But, I mean, there's – the subject matter is fairly dark and at times adult. I mean, nothing totally right. obscene, but right. I would say, I mean, if I have to, senior in high school or college.
Okay. Okay. I hope that helps, Jennifer. Katie Stover, let's move on here with our list today. And you wanted to speak about Boy Kings of Texas, the Dark Horse nominee that surprised everyone at the National Book Awards.
Yes, when the nominees were announced, this was the book that had everyone sitting up saying, well, we didn't expect to see that title, and then had everyone scrambling to find it, and that was not easy to do. It's not that it was out of print, it went out of stock almost immediately. Wow. I had trouble getting copies at the library. We only had one in the catalog, and after I read about it, I thought, this is a perfect book for a book group discussion. And one of my book groups just discussed it last month. But it's set in the dusty border town of Brownsville, Texas. And this is the author's gritty and moving coming-of-age story. And it reads like a series of getting-to-know-you stories.
Nonfiction?
It's nonfiction. It's a memoir.
Mm-hmm.
And it was nominated for the Nonfiction Prize for the National Book Award. And it kind of reads like a series of those getting-to-know-you stories that you share over beers in a local tavern, because the stories aren't really chronological. They're just like, oh, hey, this reminds me of. And he just starts telling you the story. And he talks about his father, who was always struggling with the machismo identity of the barrio and his desire to support his family and help his children out of the barrio. And his mother, who never quite fit in with the other barrio families. And then this horrible fight, this physical beating that this author has with a beloved uncle that reveals the truth behind the family's otherness and how they are perceived by the other families in the barrio. The author and his family, the uncle in this drunken, violent state, accuses the author of thinking, well, you and your family, you think you're so much better. You think you're so much better. And the author, while he's taking a punch to the mouth, he's 14 years old, realizes, yeah, we kind of do. And that's why the other barrio families resent this family, because they do feel like they can get out. And that's what the other families don't want. Because if you get out, then you prove you're better than everyone else. And if you think you want to get out. So it's really violent. It is kind of funny. And Martinez is playing with the genre of memoir here in this book. And I like that a great deal, because many times he'll begin a story saying, it might have happened like this. I think it happened like this. I remember it this way. Mm-hmm. And then he freely admits once or twice that he can't recall if this memory is his or does it belong to another family member. And once he even said it might have been a dream. But and I love that he just came right out and said, this is a memoir. It's not his autobiography. And I like that he said that. The book group talked a great deal about how he's perceiving his memories and how he even says, you know, this has changed a lot. I'm almost 40 and I'm writing about this now, and I think this has changed. And he talked to his family members, and he would eventually throw up his hands and say, well, I'm just going to write it the way I want to. But the author's writing is very colorful and
that
lyrical.
Sounds great.
It is.
Sounds
fantastic.
Terrific.
And readers really do cheer for this boy to leave his hometown. But they'll wonder if it ever truly happens.
Who first published that book? Because it was kind of a dark horse, right?
It was. It's Globe Pequot.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Well, that's pretty big, but yeah, interesting.
And Lions Press, an imprint of Globe Pequot. And let's see if I can find
it. Was it a paperback original?
It was a paperback original.
Oh, so you didn't get any money.
To start. Yeah, you would know.
That book again, Boy Kings of Texas by Domingo Martinez.
Yes.
Great recommendation, Katie. Sounds so good.
It is.
Mark Luce, The Ballad of the Sad Cafe.
It's like I got the sad books today. So Carson McCullers is a Southern writer. Her most famous work is probably The Heart is a Lonely Hunter, which is a kind of a sprawling Southern – I mean, it's almost like a – I think of her as like Flannery O'Connor without like all the like guilt and doom and – you know, if Flannery O'Connor, like you think like brimstone, then Carson McCullers is like melancholy. And so this is a shorter piece. It's a novella, and it traces the life of Miss Amelia, who runs a cafe in a very small town in the South. And Miss Amelia has been married at one point to a fellow named Marvin. Marvin got into trouble with a lot of girls when he was younger and ruined their reputation. But somehow he falls in love with Miss Amelia, and they are married, only to be separated less than a week later because the marriage is not consummated. Fast forward several years, and a small little man with a hunchback who's claiming to be Miss Amelia's second cousin, Lyman, comes in, and everybody – Miss Amelia's a very tough, gruff woman, and everybody expects her to just kick this guy out, and instead she invites him in. And so together they – we don't know really what kind of relationship they have, but they basically form a – cafe, and the town comes kind of to find respite from its kind of everyday, you know, the trials of everyday life. And then Marvin comes back at some point. He's out of prison, and there's a showdown. I mean, it's pretty straightforward. And the thing that I like so much about her is that she knows people really well, and she knows types really well, and she knows small towns really well. And I think that her interests often are the outsider, the misfit, the one who can't quite connect emotionally with everybody else. Maybe she was an introvert. Mm-hmm. But she's a wonderful writer and someone I think that doesn't get the kind of attention perhaps that she probably deserves. Because I would put her – we could argue about Flannery O'Connor all day, but I think that what McCullers is doing is not dissimilar from even sort of some of Truman Capote's short stories or some of his early fiction. And she's a Southern writer with a really good grasp of plays and a really good – and a phenomenal grasp of character and an underpinning of equality.
That's The Ballad of the Sad Cafe by Carson McCullers, a very high recommendation from Mark Luce, right?
Yes.
Okay. Just a few minutes left, so let's go through some lightning rounds here a little bit here. Jeff Van Gowdy, you wanted to speak about Tiny Beautiful Things by Cheryl Strayed. And I should point out that she will be on our program on April 23rd when she's in town to talk about her memoir, Wild, from Lost to Found,
so
and Pacific Crest Trail.
I absolutely loved this book. Somebody posted on a Facebook, a writer that I admire, that it contained the best in an advice piece, the best advice on writing that he had ever read. And I went right out and bought it, and I didn't like her advice on writing, but I love her advice on everything else. Mm. And the genesis, this is actually a collection of Dear Sugar columns from the Rumpus. And
the Rumpus?
Cheryl Strayed, it's an online
magazine.
Magazine. Okay. Cheryl Strayed is not a trained clinical psychologist at all. She just has, I wouldn't call it a treasure trove of bad experiences, but like a trash load of bad experiences. Everything has happened to her: early childhood sexual abuse, untimely death of her mother, her own dicey experiences with drugs and some promiscuity when she was a young adult, breakup of her first marriage. And it's sort of like what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Her life is just like a walking evidence of that. And this voice here is so compelling. And it reminded me of when I read Anne Lamott's Bird by Bird, when Anne Lamott was an unknown, that sort of memoir/advice book. It's just like, what a voice. And has that same sort of emotional clarity, delivers the truth, writes like a dream. And I think it's an absolutely brilliant book. And she addresses her, she addresses her readers as Sweet Pea and Pumpkin, but gives them totally hard-nosed advice. And she herself is Sugar, and she's married to Mr. Sugar, and then there's the baby Sugars. I like that one.
That's Tiny Beautiful Things by Cheryl Strayed.
I absolutely love it. Let's move
on to a book. What are you looking at there?
Well, Jeffrey, turn your mic off. Turn your earphones off, because you're not going to like this. Uh-oh. I don't want to talk about a book at all. I want to talk about an app.
An app. Yes.
Now, wait. Did you notice on the last thing? So, first of all, you found the book on Facebook.
I know.
And then you talked about an online journal.
And it started as an anonymous book. Yeah. I mean, there's so much I could have said about this, but
she's very inconsistent.
I know.
Point out that when Grace
electronically
inconsistent.
Okay,
so this is for... Somebody say that. So this is for Poetry Month.
Yeah.
And it's called Poems by Heart.
Mm.
And it was just put out on Friday by Penguin Books. And in the olden days, when I went to school, we had to memorize poetry.
We sure did.
And they don't do that anymore. And I find that really upsetting, especially because
Caroline Kennedy was sitting in Mark Luce's chair last week talking about the same thing.
I know. That's why he's hovering like that.
Yeah.
Even though scientific studies prove that memorizing poetry changes the armature of your brain and actually strengthens it, we still don't do it. And
I could use a little bit of that.
This is a fantastic little thing. It's like a little game. And I've always wanted to memorize Shall I Compare Thee to a Summer's Day? And I did the other day. Because what it does is you have all the words, and then it starts blanking out words, and you fill them in. And then before you know it, you've memorized it. It's fabulous.
That's cool.
And I think everybody should get it.
Very cool.
What's it called?
Poems by Heart. It's free, and then you buy poetry packets according to the kinds of poems that you want.
Wow.
And, but you have to have a smartphone.
Yes, you do. And the narrator.
And a microwave, too. Yeah.
You can play it on your fireplace, Jeff. So you get it. And it's narrated by my good friend Elda, who's head of Penguin, and so I get to hear her voice. But I'm going to have my kids start doing this.
That's me both.
Cool. Yeah.
That's very cool.
And by kids, I mean students.
Yeah. Katie, just very quickly, Suspect by Robert Crace.
Robert Crace, yes. This is his latest standalone thriller.
And just a few seconds.
I can sum it up in a sense. It's a thriller that's a dog story. It's going to make grown men cry.
Wow. That's succinct and to the point. That's called lightning round there. I appreciate that. Well, that's it for our book doctors today, and appreciate everyone's great suggestions. Again, I want to thank everyone, Jeffrey Ann Gowdy, Grace Saw, Katie Stover, and Mark Luce. Thank you all for coming in. Very good conversation.
Thanks for having us.
Always enjoy having you guys here. We'll post a complete list of the books we discussed today on our website, kcur.org, where you'll also find more information on all of our broadcasts. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR. Up to date, you can follow me at Steve Kraske. Tomorrow on the program, we'll sit down with a former newspaper columnist and a very good one, Ellen Goodman, for a discussion on ways to approach death as a natural part of life. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman, Danny Alexander, and Beth Lipoff. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.